Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and as this year comes to a close, we are looking back on some of the stories that dominated the news in 2013. Today we will focus on Syria's descent into hell as the civil war becomes a war of attrition, with the rebels losing ground and losing support as jihadis overwhelm their ranks, playing into Assad's hands. We begin with a broadcast of Background Briefing from January the 6th, 2013. As we assess that day's speech by the besieged Syrian dictator Bashar Assad, that was a mixture of defiance and delusion, devoid of any mention of a diplomatic possibility to end a war that is destroying Syria and has already claimed 60,000 lives. Henri Barki, a former member of the State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss the consequences of a collapse of the Assad regime and its regional impact, particularly on Iraq. He has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syria Crisis and the Future of Iraq. Then from September the 9th, 2013, we speak with award-winning investigative journalist Max Blumenthal, who is in Ramallah, Palestine, having just visited the vast Syrian refugee camps in Jordan. We discuss the appalling conditions the traumatized refugees live under and the fate of many thousands more Syrian refugees just across the border who are prevented from entering Jordan. An opponent of U.S. intervention, Max Blumenthal, was repeatedly told by the refugees that they want America to bomb Assad, even if it costs them their homes and livelihoods. Then finally, from November 19th, 2013, we go to Jordan to speak with Nicholas Harris, who is a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. We discuss the bombing of the Iranian embassy in Beirut and the war within the war amongst the Syrian rebels, where the more secular Free Syrian Army has clashed with the jihadist al-Nusra Front, who in turn have clashed with other al-Qaeda-affiliated groups like the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, turning northern Syria into a patchwork of warring fiefdoms. And joining us now is Henri Barki, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States Department of State's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored and co-authored and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization's Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. He has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barki.
Thank you.
And the President Bashar al-Assad addressed the Syrian people today from the Opera House in Damascus, and it was a speech full of defiance and delusion, but entirely devoid of any mention of a diplomatic possibility to end this war that's destroying Syria and has already claimed 60,000 lives. So are we therefore to expect more agony?
Well, yes. I mean, I think we shouldn't have expected anything else from Bashar al-Assad. I mean, essentially his regime is at stake. Whatever solution one ends up with in Syria will not include him, and he knows that. So he is going to try to survive and last until the very last moment. And he may very well end up dying in Syria, the way things are going at the moment. But he clearly doesn't understand how bad the situation is for him. It's getting worse by the day. It may still take months, maybe even a year, for him to finally lose power. But yes, you're right. There's going to be a lot more misery in Syria.
And I don't know whether you saw the video recently that was posted of the Shabiha, the pro-Assad militia, having captured some hapless prisoners. And they put two of them up against a wall and slowly slash them with knives all the time, yelling, exalting their great leader, the Lord Bashar. And then they, after slashing them, they start stabbing them in a very, I mean, it's impossible to, I'm still in shock having made the mistake of watching it. The notion that the Alawites could see the Sunni, their brother, their fellow Syrians, as nothing more than animals to be slaughtered. It's so disturbing and so hard to get your head around.
Well, we have to be careful. I mean, I started watching the video, but then I turned it off because I think it was very, very disturbing, and I'm very glad that I did not watch it. That said, there's an important point that has to be made here, and that is that not all Alawites are Shabiha. Not Alawites are killers. Not all Alawites are such depraved individuals as the ones that you saw on that video. So I think we have to be careful, and for the sake of Syria and for the sake of, you know, for human beings in Syria, that in the end, whatever emerges out of this will not be a situation where the majority of the population then goes on and slaughters the minority. I mean, they're all Syrians in the end. Yes, this regime has cynically made use of the minority to suppress the majority, and unfortunately, members of this minority will have to pay a huge price. And but it is should not be one of vengeance and violence. There are serious efforts being made, by the way, of, if you look at even at today's press reports, of lists being made of only the top government officials who are responsible for the violence and who will be charged in the aftermath of the regime's fall, so that not everybody gets accused. And I think this is an effort that has to be supported by the outside powers, by everybody, and otherwise it will be very, very grim. And I think it's not in the interest of anybody to see revenge violence in the aftermath of the fall of the regime.
And is this idea of using a minority to dominate the majority, doesn't that come out of colonialism? The British and the French, that's an old trick of theirs to empower a minority tribe and to bring them along and therefore control the country through the minority rather as opposed to empowering the majority.
Yes, but look, the Ottomans did it also in Iraq. I mean, Iraq was, when it was ruled by the Ottomans, was ruled by the Sunnis, and the British essentially inherited that system and maintained it in Iraq. So it's, yes, colonialism does this, and colonialism, when you don't have the manpower to control large territories, you will look for allies, and it's always easier to find allies in a minority. And therefore, all colonial regimes will do that. And it is not specific, I think, to France or Britain or any other colonial power. I mean, I think all powers that dominate in the end try to find these kinds of linkages. And in Iraq, we did see a minority also that maintained power for a very, very long time. And the Sunnis in Iraq, until the fall of Saddam Hussein, were 20% of the population and control the whole country. And yes, it's a remnant of the colonial, but it's also a remnant of history. So we will continue. I mean, this is not unique to Syria.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with Henri Bach. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He's also served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. And he has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. Since we've been talking about Iraq, Henri, let's turn to your article at the American Interest. And it's, you know, it's obviously it's a year since the U.S. pulled out of Iraq. And certainly the last thing one wants to reinforce is the Republican notion, John McCain and others saying that we have to stay in there. You know, the fact that it's starting to really look like it's going to fall apart is not to suggest that the U.S. should have stayed any longer than they were did, and they clearly were unwelcome. And the Iraqis called it Iraq Day, the day that the U.S. left on the 31st of December 2011. So how much is this, do you think, this unrest in Anbar and amongst the Sunnis and the heavy-handed way that al-Maliki said he's going to crack down on it? Could this be the beginning of an unraveling?
It doesn't have to be, but it could be. There's no question that the events in Syria are giving a lot of courage and encouragement, I should say, to the Sunnis in Iraq, who now see essentially another Shia offshoot regime about to fall in Damascus. and therefore they think that the Shia in Iraq will find themselves on the defensive, and this is a moment to push. And you see essentially the elements of miscalculations on both sides of the equation. That is to say, the Sunnis think that because in Syria the Bashar Assad regime is in trouble and it will be replaced by a Sunni majority government, that therefore they will get support from that new government and will be able to push their own agenda in Iraq. And the Sunnis have in Iraq have yet to accept the fact that they are actually a minority in Iraq. Now, on the other hand, Maliki is also making a huge number of mistakes by not compromising, by being heavy-handed, as you said, by picking fights with everybody. And in the process, he's essentially deepening the divisions in Iraq, not just between Sunnis and Shia, but also between Kurds and the rest of Iraq, especially the Shia. And he's even creating, actually, interestingly, some divisions within his own Shia community. We saw this week Muqtada al-Sadr, the maverick Shia leader, who essentially went out of his way to criticize Maliki and support the Sunni opposition to Maliki. So it's very difficult to understand what is Maliki's strategy here, because the longer this chaos continues, and we've seen an uptick in violence, it's not as much as it was in the bad old days, but there is certainly an uptick in violence. Don't a week goes by when a bomb explodes in a few different places in Iraq, causing casualties. Although Iraq has a bright future because it sits on huge amounts of oil, it doesn't seem like the state is working. And the more it fails in delivering services to its citizens, whether it is energy, whether it is water, whether it is basic services from the bureaucracy, you will find that people are going to try to go their own way. And that's the big danger in Iraq. And there's no question that the Syrian crisis has also undermined essentially the border between Syria and Iraq. There is really no border between those two countries anymore. I mean, people are crossing. You have violent groups moving from Syria to Iraq, from Iraq to Syria. So you're seeing essentially the erosion of the state system, if you want, in that part of the world. I mean, the famous Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916 that drew the boundaries, the colonial boundaries of Iraq and Syria, which were artificial, admittedly, are now being questioned seriously. So, yes, the continuation of this could lead to a dismemberment of Iraq. And maybe that's why it should be. Who knows? But maybe something much better will emerge out of this. But it is not going to be bloodless. That's the unfortunate part of it.
So, well, Henri Barkey, is this a zero-sum situation? In as much as Iran appears to be losing now, does that mean that Saudi Arabia and the Gulf are winning?
That's a very good question. Yes, in some ways, especially the way they look at it. I mean, in the article, I said that the two sides are essentially in a Manichaean struggle, if you want, and they would perceive any loss by Iran as a gain for themselves. But look, the Arab Spring has taught us one thing, that no one is immune from pressures from below. You know, when you think about Assad, at the beginning of the Arab Spring, Assad got up and gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal where he was so arrogant. He said, "Not these things happen in countries where the regime is not responsive to the demands of the people. But here in Syria, we are, you know, we do exactly what the people want. We are in tune." And he said he gave this interview in February, and in March the revolt started. So Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries may sit pretty on a lot of money, but there is a lot of uncertainty. That doesn't mean that the regimes will collapse, but there's going to be pressure on the regimes, especially after the Assad regime falls, because people are seeing that, you know, they can overthrow regimes, they can put pressure, they can engage or force regimes to make reforms. And the Saudi government will also be faced with unpleasant situations whereby it will have to repress. It already is doing that in the Shia parts of Saudi Arabia, in the northeastern parts of the country. Bahrain, the situation is quite dangerous, where the Shia majority is rebelling against the Sunni minority regime. That's another minority-majority crisis that has essentially now been put on the back burner because the Saudis have sent their own troops into Bahrain, and it's a small fish, it's a small place, etc. But it shows you that even in the Gulf countries, there are signs of unhappiness and there are signs of unrest. So, yes, in the short run, the Saudis will emerge victorious and will be very happy to see Assad go, and therefore the Iranians getting a black eye. But, you know, history continues. History doesn't stop with one event. And there will be other things that will affect the Saudis in different other ways.
Well, just in closing, it would seem, Henri Barki, that if you compare Assad's phony democracy that he may have thought that he could sell to an interviewer, that he responds to the will of the people, at least he had some semblance of a parliament. Saudi Arabia is an absolute monarchy. They are back in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, but look, I wasn't. Especially when you look at pictures today of after Bashar's speech. I mean, parliament in Syria was not a parliament. The fact that they had a parliament doesn't mean it was a parliament. I mean, just take 100 people off the street and put them in a building and tell them to raise their hands when you know the applause sign goes up is not necessarily a parliament. To me, there was really not that much difference between the Saudi and the Syrian regimes. In fact, one can make the argument that the Saudi control over its population is in some ways more subtle. I mean, they use religion, they use different forms of legitimacy, they use certain types of shura councils, etc. I'm not saying that what I'm just saying to say is that there was not much difference between Assad Syria and the Saudi regime. In fact, the Assad regime used far more violence to maintain power than the Saudis do. So it should.
Right, but at the end of the day,
those kinds of comparisons are kind of dangerous sometimes.
Right, and not particularly useful, but there is a distinct difference, though. Assad is a fairly secular regime, and the Saudis, even though the royal family live in luxury and have all that oil money sloshing around, they do have a tiger by the tail with the theocracy that they created.
Fair enough. But secularism in of itself is not a virtue if it comes with brute violence. So what difference does it make whether you're being repressed by a theocratic regime or by a secular regime? At the end of the day, you're being repressed and the outcome is the same. And my argument was that the secular regime in Syria is probably worse than the Saudi regime because it used much more violence.
Right.
That is not to say that the Saudi regime is necessarily that much better off, but let's face it. I mean, it does not use the kind of violence that the Syrians have used.
So, at this point, at least.
Right.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Henri Barki. Very interesting discussion. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barki. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He's authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization, Resistance, Application, and Alternatives. He has an article at the American Interest spinoff, The Syrian Crisis and the Future of Iraq. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back with a broadcast from September the 9th, 2013, about the Syrian refugee crisis in Jordan.
كان ما بتشاير فيه ولا خطي كل ظهرك عنده عكي جري قدامك شخص غريب من وين جيت من وين نبات بالمدينة انتشر فيها العب والحب حب الخلايا نامت وما عاد تفيق جيت من رواية الحي نضيف الكل يوم شوف فيه زبالة ولا وسخ عم تلعب على الطريق شوف في راس
معقد
يلا ارحل يا بشار
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 Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Ramallah in Palestine is Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest article at Mondo Weiss is Shady PR Operatives, Pro-Israel Ties, Anti-Castro Money, Inside the Syrian Opposition's DC Spin Machine. And his forthcoming book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Blumenthal.
Great to be on with you, Ian.
And you've just been in Jordan visiting the Syrian refugee camps. Describe these extraordinary cities. I believe one of them is the fourth largest city now in Jordan, right in the middle of nowhere, sitting on an aquifer, no water, no sewerage. It's a monumental problem for the Jordanian government, isn't it?
Well, it's a problem that's partly been created by the Jordanian government or established by the Jordanian government. And I'll get into that, but this is basically an open-air prison for 120,000 people, mostly from the Daraa region of Syria, which is the cradle of the revolution, the Syrian revolution. And it is, as you said, the fourth largest population center in Jordan. It's right on the Syrian border, and it's in a landscape that's starkly reminiscent of the Death Valley. You know, for your L.A. listeners, just imagine sleeping in a tent for 1 year in Death Valley with no toilet, very little water, living on grain, very poor grain and lentils. And that's kind of what these 120,000 people are experiencing. The entire camp is controlled by the Jordanian military. It's surrounded by a heavily militarized perimeter with barbed wire and surveillance. Very few people are able to leave. Most of the people I interviewed had not left the camp since arriving. And now very few people are able to get in. So there are children there that I met, 10 years old, whose mothers can't get in from Syria. And there are tens and tens of thousands of Syrian refugees on the Syrian side of the border, desperate to get in. And the Jordanian military is keeping them out. And the fear among these refugees is that they will, those people waiting on the border are the next to be attacked by Assad.
So what's your understanding of why the Jordanians are being duplicitous about their humanitarian? I mean, what they're putting out is we are the small nation overburdened and we're doing the Lord's work here in humanitarian terms. You're saying there's a certain cynicism here.
Yeah, it's like the Lebanese with the Palestinians. They don't want to integrate them into their society and give them civilian rights. The Jordan's controlled by a Hashemite minority already, and they don't want any more pressure. So they're literally warehousing these people. And when you go in there, I was given permission by the Jordanian government, to their credit, to go in. But it didn't come in time. So I actually sort of snuck into the camp with an experienced journalism professor from Amman who knows the people in the camp. And I was able to get a really unvarnished view of life in the camp because this woman really knew the people. And the conditions they're living in are just abominable, absolutely abominable. And you see the malnutrition in the children. You see that there's no psychological care. The kids are unable to go to school. You walk into a tent, which an entire family of 6 to 10 is sleeping in. You can't stand up in there. And you start asking questions about where they came from in Homs or Daraa. And it's like you're peering into a blood-spattered window into hell when you hear them talk about the massacres that they endured. 90% of the people I interviewed there, out of dozens of people, had survived the massacre, and the majority of them have had family members or neighbors slaughtered in front of them. And now they're sleeping in tents. There's a huge section in the camp of NGOs. In trailers, and there are bathrooms in that section. But when you go into the camp, people have to pay to get these sort of corrugated tin trailers that they refer to as caravans. They have to pay for it, otherwise they're stuck in tents. One old widow I interviewed could not sleep in her tent anymore because she was constantly attacked by snakes. So she went to sleep with another family. And so I interviewed the children of that family, and all they complained to me about was being attacked every night by wild dogs. So there's so much media and so much attention focused on the Zaatari refugee camp, and there are so many NGOs in there, but they can't seem to address any of these basic problems for these people who are basically being warehoused with no hope to return to where they're from.
And Max Blumenthal, you say there are even more people on the Syrian side of the border, just across the border, wanting to get into Jordan. So that would indicate that this is not a fate worse than death, right?
No, I mean, these people escape with their lives, but, you know, I also went to ask them what they thought of the U.S. intervention in Syria, something that I'm staunchly against. I think could be disastrous and could create more refugees waiting on that border. And, you know, we can get into that, but what everyone in this camp wants is the U.S. to hit Syria as hard as possible. I mean, it's understandable. These are traumatized people who witnessed their families massacred in front of their eyes. That's what they want. And one person told me it was particularly poignant, a man from Homs, whose village witnessed a massacre, he said, of 1,000 people from Shabiha and Syrian army forces. He told me, if you're not going to hit Syria, then hit us, because our life is unbearable here and we're dying every day inside. So that's their attitude. It's a nihilistic attitude, and it's completely uniform throughout the camp. People of all walks of life, although most in the camp are farmers who really want to go back to their land. The only way they see a path to return is through foreign intervention. It's just really unfortunate that, you know, from my perspective, U.S. intervention won't actually give them what they want.
Well, they're not getting what they want and need from the international humanitarian community. This is obviously being run by the UNHCR. So who's not ponying up? You've got all those NGO people living in air conditioning trailers right next to these people who are suffering so much. Is this just a comment on the kind of the realities of international humanitarian activity?
Yeah, absolutely. And just the fact that none of these NGOs are able to put any pressure on the Jordanian government, which is sort of a strategic bulwark for the U.S. between Israel and Syria and Iraq and Saudi Arabia. So the U.S. is not going to put any pressure on the Jordanian government. It's the Jordanian military that controls this camp. It's the Jordanian military that's keeping the Syrian refugees out of the camp. It's the Jordanian military that's keeping them on the border. It's the Jordanian military that they say is stealing their passports and preventing them from ever leaving the camp, keeping them basically in an open-air prison. And it's, at the head of this whole thing, it's the great U.S. ally, King Abdullah. This is happening under his watch. So the people there, they don't want better aid. That's not what they were telling me. They want some kind of solution so they can return, so they don't wind up like Palestinians who are living in these camps in perpetuity, if not for eternity. Their wounds are still fresh, and they, you know, the one thing to them that will heal the wounds is that they can go back over the border. I had one 12-year-old girl tell me that when Assad falls, I'll walk back to my village in Daraa. And she was wearing sandals. I said, "You're going to walk with those little sandals?" She said, "I'll walk barefoot." That's the mentality in this camp.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's in Ramallah, Palestine. He's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and a New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest article at Mondo Y says, Shady PR Operatives, Pro-Israel Ties, Anti-Castro Money, Inside the Syrian Opposition's DC Spin Machine. And his forthcoming book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. But the news today that the Russians have run with this offhand remark that Secretary of State Kerry made about that the Syrians, if they allowed international oversight over their chemical arsenals and had them removed and destroyed, then maybe we won't bomb them. And the Russians and the Syrians are running with that idea, and it may well avoid this U.S. impending attack. What would these people in the camps think of the idea that Assad has been let off the hook?
The people in the camps already feel like Assad has been let off the hook because the U.S. has telegraphed its punches and said that the Obama administration has gone to Congress and is waiting so long and going over so many political hurdles. I think I'm glad Obama went to Congress because we can actually have a democratic decision about going to war. But what people in the camp told me was very informed by their own conversations with people back in the villages and towns where they live. One woman from a town called Suleiman, to the east of Homs, I think, told me that the Assad regime has begun moving tanks into the town. And this is a town where they committed massacres in April. I think there was a notorious massacre on April 25th. And the commander came and said, we're going to give you preferable treatment, provide you with services and food if you allow us to keep these tanks here, because then the tanks will be in a residential area that the U.S. won't be able to bomb. And the people in the camp believe that Assad is basically hiding and stashing all of his important field equipment in towns that the Syrian army controls, and that no U.S. strikes will have any effect on his military capacity. And so, therefore, it won't turn the tables in favor of the Free Syrian Army.
But when you say that the young 12-year-old girl with these thin sandals is prepared to walk back across the desert to her hometown of Deraa on the border inside Syria when Assad falls, it doesn't look like Assad's going to fall, does it?
In fact, John Kerry testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that Assad will not fall. And yesterday he said these will be incredibly small attacks. Which means, what does that mean, incredibly small attacks? I've never heard a U.S. leader say something like this before. Are they going to have a flaming paper bag on Assad's doorstep, courtesy of Obama's dog, Bo? I mean, what does this mean? And at the same time, Kerry is saying this is a Munich moment. In other words, Assad is Hitler, but we're going to attack him with incredibly small attacks. So it's really a confusing message coming out of Washington, and the people in the camp are confused. And what they want is punishing airstrikes. One woman told me, bring all our houses down. We accept civilian casualties, and we'll build the houses again. You know, I don't accept that. I don't think that's going to resolve anything. But that's the attitude of people in the camps who've been traumatized and witnessed their families massacred in front of their eyes.
But this even greater population that you mentioned that's just inside Syria or on the border wanting to get out, but the Jordanian army won't let them in to these horrible conditions that the refugees that have escaped are living under, that yeah. If Assad wins, then wouldn't they be massacred or in danger? I mean, they'd be caught between a rock and a hard place, right?
That's such an important question. And when I interviewed the adults, pretty much anyone who's an adolescent or over, they refused to give me their real name or their full name. They would not have their faces photographed. The children are happy to be photographed. They love being photographed. But the adults, if the adults are behind the children, there are some women behind the children, they'll cover their faces with their hijab. That's the level of terror that they're experiencing. They feel like if their names are ever recorded anywhere, that Assad's Mukhabarat will record their name and they'll never be able to go back. And if they go back, they'll be tortured to death. Not just that, but the level of fear in the camp is so intense that many people told me they fear that Assad will attack them with chemical weapons, just to wipe them out as the final blow in his victory tour. I mean, obviously, I don't think there's any basis for saying that. It's just that really speaks to the level of fear that he's managed to instill in this population. I mean, it's incredible. You walk to any part of this camp, the new arrivals section, the older residents were there for 12 or 11 months. And it's just stunning how comprehensive the campaign of violence and massacres Assad was able to carry out was, that everyone there, 120,000 people, has directly experienced a massacre or shelling.
So what's your explanation, Max Blumenthal, for attitudes on the American left, who are much more critical now of the Syrian opposition and keep referring to the al-Nusra front as the jihadis and saying, you know, there was a front page picture on the New York Times the other day of them executing a bunch of captured Syrian soldiers. And, you know, it's pretty obvious that this whole agony in Syria is brought on by the dictator. In the town of Dara, they rose up. And some teenage boys, I think about 14 or 15, wrote some graffiti on the wall against the divine right of the ruling family, and they were tortured and mutilated in response. And that is how the Assads do business, and they brought this destruction upon this country because they insist that it's their divine right to rule, and it's either the Assad family or the terrorists. And that... I'm astounded that people don't see who really are the people that have brought about this agony and who essentially to this day not only won't take responsibility for what's happening in their own country, but they're prepared to bring the whole place down if indeed their rule is threatened.
The issue is how to end the agony. It's not really a debate anymore about who's responsible. Obviously, I hold Assad responsible. We did an interview, I think, a year ago about my resignation from Al-Akhbar, which is a leftist Lebanese publication. I resigned over the fact that they had slanted their editorials and coverage in favor of Assad. And I believe that he is a brutal criminal who needs to go. There's no way around that. And he's not an anti-imperialist hero. And Hezbollah's activities in Syria have really lowered their credibility in the Arab world. And so I think the issue is how do you end this misery? And the U.S. has done very little to push on Russia and push on Iran. And Russia and Iran I've seen reports that they're coming up with a counter proposal to a U.S. strike. Which sounds positive. But the issue is a U.S. strike going to do anything to end the misery of these people in Zaatari and the misery of the refugees in the border? And it's just from an objective standpoint. I think it's only going to exacerbate the situation. Obama and Kerry are talking about a symbolic strike. Obama called it a shot across the bow. And that's not anything that's going to change the situation on the ground. If anything, Assad will emerge after U.S. strikes, declare victory, and then increase repression. What I've heard from one person I interviewed from Homs is that detonated dynamite charges have been placed in a central prison in Homs, which is filled with political prisoners, and they're just preparing to detonate at any minute if the U.S. strikes. I've heard that prisoners were moved into sensitive areas that the U.S. might strike. So we're looking at a situation where repression increases, Assad's power is potentially consolidated, and the U.S., if it's judged that the U.S. strike doesn't work in the beginning, it could escalate. It could escalate beyond this incredibly small strike that Kerry promised into something that could last for weeks and cause massive civilian casualties, could involve Iran, could involve Hezbollah. Who knows what could happen? I think that's really where the left is coming from, and from its anti-interventionist standpoint. And I'm really, I really sympathize with the third way standpoint that emerged from the Arab left at the beginning of the revolution, which is an anti-Assad, an anti-U.S. intervention perspective that the Syrian people are going to have to be able to demonstrate agency and be the real owners after Assad is gone.
But nothing's going to get rid of Assad. So this looks like evil will triumph. And what would it take to get rid of Assad? Short of what, international or unilateral intervention.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of intervention will get rid of them, and what will come after? Those are serious questions that need to be entertained. And I don't think al-Nusra is particularly as strong as the left and the anti-war movement is making it out in the U.S., but the Iraqi wing of al-Qaeda is appearing increasingly at the front lines. And FSA, they're not exactly some heroic figures that I really identify with. But then again, I've always said this, Syrians have a right to take up arms against Assad. He's a criminal. He has to go. But the U.S. doesn't seem to have any clear, coherent plan, and that speaks to the unpopularity of this war. No one really understands what they want when Kerry says there has to be a political solution, and at the same time, they're promising airstrikes.
Well, Max Blumenthal, I thank you for joining us, and we'll have to just do a follow-up because it looks as if there may be a way out if the Russian and the Russian offer may well be accepted, and Assad will live to rule another day. So, unfortunately,
I hope this offer is accepted, and there are political forces in Washington that will fight against this. What could potentially be a really reasonable offer. One of those forces is AIPAC, which is not particularly interested in Syria. It's interested in the U.S. attacking Iran on behalf of the Israeli government. It's interested in the U.S. tightening sanctions on Iran. And one of the things that Iran might ask for is a loosening of sanctions, which would be, completely reasonable proposal to ameliorate the misery of all these people. And so we have to start looking at the forces in Washington that are working against conciliatory measures. We have to look at the fact that the FSA has rejected dialogue repeatedly, as well as the fact that Bashar Assad is a brutal criminal who has to go. But I think we have to really, as Americans, be most critical about the forces in Washington and our political system that are making it that are darkening the future of the people I met in the Za'atari refugee camp beyond the level that Assad has.
But these are people, though, that have said to you they want the U.S. to bomb this guy, and they want even their own homes blown up. So I just wanted to end up with a coherent message here, because I understand the dilemma of being against U.S. intervention on the one hand, but how do you deal with this evil regime?
You and I have no influence over the outcome of this. The Obama administration's made up its mind, and it's possible that it'll bomb, regardless of what Congress does. And at this point, you're looking at 190 votes leaning against or against use of force. So they're going to have to make up their mind, and we'll see what happens. It troubles me that it may have reached a situation where it's too late, and it may be too late to do anything beyond diplomacy and some kind of negotiated solution. I thought maybe a year ago or a year and a half ago, the U.S. could have acted or intervened in a way that might have brought Assad down and prevented all these people from leaving. The people in Za'atari camp have left in the last five, most of them have left in the last 5 to 11 months. That was a key period. The Obama administration did nothing then for them. And it's waited till this arbitrary red line was crossed. People were being bombed at bakeries. People were being slaughtered waiting for bread at bakeries. The Obama administration did nothing. And this is another thing that people in the camps find puzzling and people in the U.S. find puzzling. But people in the camps have been reduced to a situation of desperation. They're comprehensively traumatized, and they're willing to accept any possible solution to give them a future, because right now they have none. And, I think I'm staunchly against intervention for my own reasons. But as a journalist, I think their voices have to be heard, and we have to listen to them and put them at the center of the conversation we're having about intervening.
Well, Max Blumenthal, I thank you so much for joining us here from Ramallah in Palestine.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Max Blumenthal, who is in Ramallah, Palestine. He's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republic and Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. His latest article at Mondo Weiss is Shady PR Operatives, Pro-Israel Ties, Anti-Castro Money, Inside the Syrian Opposition's DC Spin Machine. And his forthcoming book is Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a broadcast from November the 19th with an analyst on the Syrian opposition and the war within a war amongst the rebels. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Jordan is Nicholas Herra, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Herra.
Thank you for having me.
And there has been, of course, the bombing of the Iranian embassy in Lebanon, in Beirut. Already the Iran's foreign minister has blamed Israel for the attack, but the Syrian government statement blames Saudi Arabia, quoting, "Each of the terrorist attacks that strikes in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq reek of petrodollars." It's pretty clear what they're saying there. So just to start with this, I know we're going to be talking about the Kurdish region and the war within a war that's going on amongst the rebels in northern Syria. This seems to be like the southern front. I mean, this is an extremely complicated mosaic, is it not?
Yes, it is. The attacks today on the Iranian embassy are probably the most blatant statement by forces against the al-Assad regime and its allies, Iran and Hezbollah, that has occurred since the bombings over the summer in the southern Beiruti suburbs of Dahiya, a traditional Hezbollah stronghold where many of the party's constituents live. Soon after the attacks, a Sunni Islamist armed opposition group, which claims to be based in Lebanon, the Abdullah Azzam Brigade, stated it had made the attack in order to force Hezbollah to withdraw its fighters from Syria, which have been fighting in support of the al-Assad government. These attacks are again aimed at areas that are considered core support for al-Assad, but how much impact they'll actually have on the fighting on the ground in Syria is questionable. Right now, Hezbollah is reported to be assisting the Syrian army in many key strategic areas of the fighting in Syria, particularly a range of mountains and badlands north and northwest of Damascus called the Jabal Kalamun. And the importance of this area is that it lies on the strategic M5 highway, which connects Damascus, still the capital of the al-Assad government, to its core areas of support in the western governorates of Syria, such as Homs and Latakia and Tartus governorates, where a majority of the Alawite minority support lives for the al-Assad government.
And I was just going to mention, Nicholas Herra, that the Iranian cultural attaché at the embassy in Beirut, Sheikh Ibrahim Ansari, apparently is among the dead. But the point that you're making is, I guess, that the al-Assad regime, with the help of Hezbollah, are rolling back a lot of the gains of the rebels and more isolating the rebel enclave in the Damascus suburbs.
Yes, yes. And in fact, the reason, part of the motivation for this attack on the Jebel Kalimun area has been in order to do exactly that, is to isolate some of the more formed opposition groups, particularly the Islamist Liwa al-Islam and its sometimes allies, the Al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra, and other groups such as the militant Salafist armed opposition group Ahrar al-Sham, from being able to strike at the M5 highway, which has been a target for the armed Syrian armed opposition groups since at least last summer. The fight in the Syrian town of Al-Qusayr, which concluded in June, which was at the time considered the most highly strategic town, which lied near the M5 highway, which ended in a victory for Hezbollah and the Syrian military, and militias drawn up under the National Defense Army, which are local defense units that, if not in support of the Assad government, are at least tolerant of the regime and are fearful of the alternative being on the armed Islamist opposition groups. And this offensive, which has been described as being in a slow burn, is now seems to be flaring up. And the result has been a large number of refugees from Syria coming into Lebanon. Some recent figures suggest that you have upwards of 18 to 30,000 refugees that have fled into Lebanon from the area of Jebel Kalimun over the weekend. And the fight in that area, in many ways, is an existential battle for the armed opposition. It has been trying unsuccessfully for over a year now to cut off Damascus from what is considered the core heartland of the Syrian government's support. And it blames Hezbollah, which many Hezbollah-controlled areas are contiguous with this region of Syria, for extending the life of the al-Assad government.
So just in the last minute or so then, Nicholas Herrer, my understanding is that the Assad regime has actually gone after the more secular groups, the more Free Syrian Army groups with greater firepower, and haven't pursued the Salafist groups quite as zealously, because the Salafists, Saudi-backed, Qatari-backed, and frankly, I find it very hard to understand how Saudi Arabia, that is a very tightly run country with a very strong secret police and religious police as well, why they continually say, well, I'm sorry, we can't stop the flow of money. This is just private money. This is not official state money. It seems very inconsistent that the state, such a tightly run state, can't control the outflow of money. But that aside, it seems that the whole idea of these Salafist groups and their backing from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf has played right into Assad's hands.
Yes, it has. And it's also, and that's an important point to raise, because one of the most powerful armed opposition groups in Damascus, the capital, Liwa al-Islam, which is the focus of the current Syrian military and Hezbollah offensive in that area, the Jabal al-Moon, north of Damascus, has reports of having strong ties with Saudi intelligence. And some estimate that it's received millions of dollars in financial assistance from the Saudi government and Saudi intelligence. And this axis, the Syrian government under Bashar al-Assad and Hezbollah under Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, consistently made this point throughout the conflict. They've created a narrative of resistance. And their narrative of resistance, which before had been part of an axis of resistance with Iran and at one point Hamas and other concerned parties, had always been aimed towards Israel, towards confronting Israel, towards hope winning one day, winning back Jerusalem and all the lands of Palestine and forcing back the Israeli foe, has now shifted to a new narrative of resistance. And this narrative of resistance isn't necessarily new. Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, during what some could argue credibly was an actual civil war from 1976 to 1982, where the militant Salafist Fighting Vanguard group actively waged attacks against Syria, the Syrian military, which is military, and also members of the Ba'ath Party, that it perceived to be part of a corrupt Alawite-dominated government, the precursor in many ways to Arab fighters that would go and join Osama bin Laden's movement in Afghanistan, and then the precursor to all these hardcore militant self-defense movements that we see now today in Syria as history turns again. This narrative of resistance that's been cultivated by Bashar al-Assad, a reinvention of his father's narrative of resistance, which has been added to Hezbollah's narrative of resistance, now focuses on these militant self-defense groups and aligns them as the main dagger being wielded by a conspiracy of Gulf Arab, Sunni and Gulf Arab monarchy states, the United States and the West writ large, and Israel, in order to defeat the axis of resistance and to weaken or destroy their ability to confront Israel and to confront what they implied, the government of Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah, and the Islamic Republic of Iran, as imperialism. And this is an important point because going along with sectarian community fears, the fears of communities such as Christians, the fears of some Sunnis who do not trust the more hardline elements in the armed opposition, other communities such as the Druze and the Alawites, the minority Alawite community, which the Al-Assad regime draws hardest core support. These fears very neatly go along with this renewed sense and this renewed message of resistance narrative against a foreign conspiracy wielding militant jihadism to destroy what had been a secular Syrian regime.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Nicholas Harrow. We haven't even got to the even further complication of what's happening in the Kurdish area of Syria, which is similar to what happened in Iraq 10 years ago, where the Kurds sense an opportunity to right old wrongs and reverse the Arabization and, of course, seize the oil reserves. This has even prompted the Barzani, the head of the Kurdish autonomous area of northern Iraq, to accuse the Syrian Kurdish group PYD of being in league with Assad to wreck a golden opportunity for Kurdish unity in Syria. So that is a further complication we don't have time to discuss. But I really appreciate you joining us here today from Jordan, Nicholas Herra.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Herra, who is an analyst with the Washington, D.C. think tank, the Jamestown Foundation, and a contributing editor and analyst with the international affairs journal Fair Observer. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in the Jamestown Foundation's publications, among other publications, and he joined us from Jordan. This has been a special retrospective of Background Briefing from 2013. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.